So this weekend we've been reflecting on faith and what that really means for us as people who are on a particular path that is cultivating more awareness of what's happening within us and what that relationship is to the world and how the world's relationship to us, what that brings up inside of us. It's not about the blind faith where we just take some idea in, somebody else's idea of what things, how things are, how things should be, but it's how we see for ourselves. I love that saying in the Dharma, ehi pasiko. How many of you have heard that? Ehi pasiko. Come and see for yourself. It's not about believing what somebody else believes or says. I remember when I first met Manindra, I would hear him say that a lot to people. People would say how wonderful he is or what he's presenting or and kind of put it on him, you know, and the lineage that he was in. But he would say to them in one way or another, he would say, come and see for yourself. Come and see for yourself. And it wasn't about him. It wasn't about how he was a light. It was about how others could see the light in themselves. So when we look at the word faith, saddha, S-A-D-D-H-A, I mentioned yesterday and the night before that it's really a verb. And it's sort of like something that we do, something that we act out in our lives. It's not a commodity. And when I looked up that word in Pali, in the Pali dictionary, and kind of when it was separated out to see where it was coming from, the etymology of it, the last three letters, D-H-A, are representing something that is being done. Like, for example, it says in the Pali Dictionary, D-H-A, the last three letters of that word, saddha, means to establish, to place, to put. All of these are verbs. It's something that we're actually cultivating in ourselves. It's to establish your trust, because that is what the manifestation of saddha is to establish trust. And what do we establish trust in? We establish trust in what we know for ourselves is onward leading. We know for ourselves what is valuable. I mentioned, and also just as a review, that saddha is regarded as a hand that seeks out and takes hold of what is beneficial, and it places that on one's heart. So one of the definitions of saddha is to place what is valuable onto one's heart, not to, you know, but to really understand it from a heart-based recognition. So it takes what's beneficial, it seeks out the qualities of virtue in oneself and in others. It seeks out virtue itself. We always value here the precepts of non-harming, the five precepts of non-harming that we take as householders, not to take anything that hasn't been offered, not to take any kind of life in any way, and not to use our sexual energy to harm one another intentionally or unintentionally, not to do our best to refrain from saying things that are untrue, to do our best to refrain from taking any intoxicants or anything that will alter the mind or make the mind less aware. These are the five precepts of non-harming, and I love the way that they are presented in our lineage. As you know, when maybe some of you have taken the precepts over and over again, they're translated in this way, I will undertake the training to refrain from, and all these ways. It doesn't say just to do good, but very precisely what to refrain from. Stealing, taking life, taking things, ingesting things that will make the mind unclear, and so forth and so on. So the faith seeks out what is beneficial for oneself, for others. The four things that it seeks out is, number one, virtuous friends. So it seeks out around us the support that will help us. People who behave and who speak in a virtuous manner, in a non-harming manner, to the best of their ability. Of course, you know, we're not perfect, but we do the best we can. It seeks out hearing and reading the Dharma, seeks out understanding through that way, through that avenue. So always we want to put ourselves as much as we can in front of virtuous people who can speak the Dharma, or that write things that inspire us to do what is beneficial for ourselves and others. We seek out opportunities to practice and to develop wisdom on many levels. Not just the, you know, the, when we talk about wisdom in the Dharma, we talk about deeply understanding impermanence, the impersonal nature of things, the unsatisfactory nature of life when we cling to what we think is going to bring us lasting happiness and we see it doesn't happen that way. It's unsatisfactory because things are impermanent. It's not just that we learn in our practice here. It's not just on the sitting cushion. We learn how to relate to one another so that there's more harmony between us. We learn how to say and do things that bring peace and happiness in the world and in our inner world as well. So this practice, opportunities to practice and develop wisdom on many levels, it isn't just the wisdom of seeing impermanence and the impersonality and the unsatisfactory nature of all of life. It's the wisdom of knowing how to relate in this world with one another. And the fourth is the cultivation of generosity as a practice. So that's why the whole of the Dharma, and how I so treasure this particular Sangha and the way that it is being run, it is being offered to all. It's being offered on the basis of generosity, on the basis of dana, so that we have this opportunity always to relinquish places of holding in ourselves. It's the basis for letting go. You know, some of us have this aspiration to be able to let go at the very last moment of our life without any regrets. I mean, that's my aspiration. I know I'll have some regrets, but I hope I'll be able to forgive myself at that moment also. And some of us have the aspiration to be able to let go completely even before dying, to let go of greed, hatred, and delusion. And that all comes from this incredible practice of, the basis of that is being able to give of ourselves in service and give of our life, maybe when we can, of our material resources, of our ability to just be present with people when they speak of their pain or their happiness, to just be present. So the cultivation of generosity, all these ways of giving are practiced in this Sangha. And that's why it's so important. I know sometimes when I have to give the understanding of dana to others, or when I hear it, you know, I think, oh, these people have heard it over and over again. But I really appreciate that people would stand up and say, this is the practice that has been the Dharma has been offered because, continually, because of generosity. And they say that, I mean, some of us say that when we have to really start charging, that's when it's going to get lost, because that practice of giving, the very basis of the Dharma, will get lost. So the practice of generosity helps us to relinquish attachment. That's what we're really letting go of when we practice generosity. It helps us to generate connection, that sense of being in a place that's where we're connected to goodness all around us. It helps us to generate compassion for one another. So these energies, these practices, serve as a spiritual compass to us. When we have these around us, these qualities that Sada brings to us, because we actually reach out with wisdom for these to be around us, then we know that we're headed in the right direction. Somehow that gives us a greater sense of settledness in our hearts. We can place our hands on our hearts and know that we're headed in the right direction. So it serves as a spiritual compass, constantly pointing us in the direction of what's beneficial to us, what's onward leading, what will really lead us to the deepest or highest goal that sometimes we don't even recognize for ourselves. Freedom from the habit patterns that create suffering for ourselves and others. So that's why sadha, the manifestation of sadha, is to establish trust. It's the establishment of trust. Greater trust, really, where? Where is that trust? It's not out there. But because of all of these things, the direction that we're headed in and what we seek with wisdom, we trust ourselves. And that's what's important on the path, is that we trust ourselves. That's what gives us the clarity and the courage to keep going on. It's, of course, we can trust others around us, our sangha, our community, virtuous members of the community. And maybe they're not completely virtuous. I mean, I say that because I know I'm not completely virtuous. But I still can trust myself, because I know that mostly I know where I need to be in my heart in order for greater happiness and peace to occur around me. So mostly we know that as people here together, individuals and as a group. So the characteristic is trusting. When there is trust, it's said that there's a greater ability to see how things are. So when we sit and we're quiet, and when we're at peace with ourselves, with whatever virtuous qualities that we know we have, and we know we're supported by those around us, then aren't we more settled in ourselves? It's like we sit down to a still forest pool in ourselves, and not a pool that's tumbling around with, what did I say wrong? What did I do wrong? And I mean, that's still there, but we're able to be with it more. And we're able to see more clearly in that pond what's going on here. There may be ruffling, there may be quite a bit of things floating around, but still we're able to see with greater clarity what is going on. So it's said that the function of sadha in the mind is to clarify. It's like that stone, that clarifying stone that's put in muddy water, is that trust, is that faith. And when you put it in that muddy water, all the mud settles to the bottom, or a good part of it, so that we can see more clearly what's happening. All sides can be seen. We're not just hanging on to the blissful part of life and saying and being attached to that, nor are we denying the suffering. So all of it can be seen. As Carl Jung said, enlightenment isn't just seeing bodies of light. It is making the darkness known. Making the darkness known. Not being afraid of either one, of seeing the attachment to the bliss or seeing the dark side, the shadow side of our hearts and our minds. It takes a lot of courage to be able to do that. And so it says that when we're able to clarify what's really going on, what's beneficial, what's not beneficial, to be able to suss that out, not just opening to part of it, like all the beauty of the path or the beauty of the practice. When we come to practice, usually we say, I want to open to all of life. But what we see on the path is how we're just hanging on a lot to what's beautiful. Or we may have the habit pattern of just going to the pain all the time and being identified with that. Whatever it is, it's not just one thing or another. It's opening to it all. So when we say we want to open to life, can it mean that for us? Opening to everything that happens. Not in denial, nor insisting that it be a certain way, like peaceful. So we're able to have that courage that can, as it says in the ancient texts, to cross the flood of life that brings everything. You know, it's not just a flood, sometimes it's a tsunami. You know, and we have to know how to handle that, how to navigate our way through that. So crossing the flood not just means the outer circumstances, but the inner circumstances, that when we doubt ourselves or when we feel there's fear about going forth, or when we're blaming others, all of the ways that bring that inability to cross the flood. So we have courage, and then this courage manifests as resolution. So the trusting goes into the clarity goes into the resolution, the decisiveness to know this is what I can do, at least right now. It may not be like tomorrow or for the whole of that flood that you want to navigate across and know what's at the end of it. We really don't know, even our best laid out plans. I don't know any plan that I've made that has turned out exactly where I wanted it to turn out. So we see that one thing can bring another, and that decisiveness, that ability to have some kind of resolution that I'm going to take a step and be present with where I am, and as I take that step forward, this is what I can do, the best that I can do. So it manifests as that decisiveness to take that step, and with that, that courage and that energy comes. So you can see how that faith in oneself, one thing can lead to another. So faith has a lot to do with trusting that our virtuous friends will stick beside us and help us. But maybe they have their own problems and they can't always be there for us. Where we really have to trust, where the faith really has to come, is from ourselves, towards ourselves. So there were many moments, and I think that you will see in yourselves how moments that you've gone in your practice. Many of you have taken longer retreats and known, you know, times when I'm going home, or this is not working now, or whatever it is, and you say, I can't go on. And I love this from Samuel Beckett. He says in one of his poems and writings, he says, I can't go on, but I go on. And that's the feeling that we have with trust, with faith. We admit this is how we feel. I can't go on. But there's that next moment of trust and faith, and we know I can go on, and it's possible to go on. And in going on, we, you know, we become a different person in a way, that all those strong and virtuous qualities of mind become more available to us. They become more clear to us also. Another quote from a very important person in my life, Charles Dubois. He said, "The important thing is this, to be able at any moment to sacrifice what we are now for what we could become." And this is leading back to what they say, the proximate cause of faith to arise. There are two ways that I've read this in the text. One way is the proximate cause is suffering. The proximate cause for faith to arise is suffering. Because when we suffer, that's when we just have no other choice but either we give up or we tune in to the faith that we have inside of us to keep going and to see that maybe we can sacrifice that moment of no courage for a moment of realizing that, yes, we have courage. We can do it. We can go on, whatever it is. And we become a better person for it. It's also said to be complete that the proximate cause for faith to arise is something to have faith in. And so both, I see that both can be true. We can have faith in trusting ourselves. We can have faith in people around us who trust us. We can borrow their faith. We can have faith in virtuous qualities of others and say, if that can happen for them, that they can overcome something that's difficult, I can too, as I spoke about yesterday. So what prevents or contaminates that feeling of clear resolve? It's the opposite of faith, doubt. And so doubt is of the five hindrances. They're called hindrances because they hinder our ability to see clearly. When doubt arises, it's really important to see doubt. It's the most, I feel, the most difficult of the five to see when doubt is arising. So how does doubt arise? It's important to get some clues of when doubt is there. A lot of times doubt arises as wavering. Should I do this? Should I do that? It's indecision. Should I cross the flood or not? You know, should I stay or should I go? It's kind of that wavering quality. It doesn't know yet. It's still trying to know more what to do. Really, that's what's happening. It's not because of cowardliness, actually. It's because of one doesn't have all the pieces of the puzzle to know sometimes. The biggest piece of the puzzle is to understand that doubt is present. And that can be the piece of the puzzle that clarifies everything. Just to know that, oh, this is wavering, indecision. This is a manifestation of doubt. So just to know that doubt or delusion is present, doubt is the one quality of mind that is fed by delusion the most. So sometimes we see that just don't know. Well, can that be known? Just don't know in this moment. Can it be known? When that's known, it's like all of a sudden we get a hit of delight that the mind knows something. It's interesting to notice that when the mind knows a hindrance, when awareness knows that a hindrance is present, or when awareness knows that a particular hindrance is present, actually there's delight in the mind because there is knowing. Because there is knowing. Because wisdom has entered the mind. It seems like, and that's why Anu Tejaniya is teaching, it's not about like going to the object of what's happening all the time. It's staying with the awareness of what's going on. Because when we can stay with the awareness, It also knows, it's knowing what's going on, but it's not getting identified with what's going on. And so in this way, when we're with the awareness of what's going on, we notice the upsurge of energy in the mind when there is wisdom. The wisdom is knowing the hindrance, and it's not getting identified with the hindrance. So when you feel delight in the mind, that knowing is wisdom. And what the mind is uplifted by is that wisdom. It's not being dragged down by the hindrance. So it's so important to understand. It's to keep enough of a space between the object and the knowing of it. Not so much so that it's dull or kind of surface-like. Sometimes the mind, the hindrance actually can enter, it does enter the awareness field, but it's not identified with it. So there's that feeling in the mind, that understanding that, oh, this is what's going on now. It's not like, oh no, another hindrance. It's more like, aha, this is what's happening. So when you get that feeling, it's really a strength of your mind is happening. So the opposite of what contaminates resolve is doubt, mostly. When we feel disheartened, doubt can be there. When we feel that we are intellectualizing what's going on, when we're in doubt, we try to intellectualize too much, overly so. What Crystal was talking about was not intellectualizing it. It was more like just knowing the parts of what's happening. That's not psychologizing or intellectualizing. It's just kind of understanding the parts of what came up in her practice. But when we do it too much, you know, when we go too far, or like Manindra says, the thought of your mother is not your mother. You know, when we go back into like, this is what happened and this is why I turned out to be like I am now, and how I was in high school, and you know, we go on and on like that. Think too much about it. So be careful about that. So what we begin to understand is this kind of noble resolve, this noble resolution that we can have in our minds to basically in the moment of our practice and in our daily life is to just stay with it, just to stay with what's going on within us and see how that is kind of interacting with what's surrounding us. Be aware. Can we be aware of what's going on inside? Can we be aware of how it's impacting others? So this resolve is really important. It takes training to be able to kind of come to ourselves and know that this faith has turned into the resolve to stay with what's going on, to stay with the dukkha, with the difficulty, not just in here, but even in a bigger picture, to just stay with it. So mostly it's the resolve to keep going, not to find, to fix it, or not to get to some place where you're finally peaceful, but it's to stay with even what's difficult. So I just want to, the Buddha talked about the four resolves, and I want to include that, even though some of them may not be directly, we're not directly talking about now. These are the four resolves. The resolve for wisdom is the first one. So wisdom can be being aware of knowing what's going on and being clear about that. That's a moment of wisdom. And that brings deeper and deeper wisdom to us. The resolve for truth, the truth of how it is, not just kind of pining after how we think it should be or how it was in the past, can it still be now, or how we want it to be in the future, but the truth of how it is right now. The resolve for generosity, the resolve for the ability to let go, the ability to develop compassion, connection. This is all about generosity. The resolve for peace, of course, that peace that goes beyond understanding it all, that peace that just can rest. So you've all been practicing resolve, and when you're here, you know, you're waiting, you're sitting here and trying to get through a sitting, pain in the back, or, you know, that pick in your knee, that, you know, ice pick in your knee, and you're wondering, when is the bell going to ring? We're practicing resolve all the time. You know, we're doing our walking practice, and I know when I was starting to do my practice, and I do my walking practice, I would have this resolve to say, from here to the end of my walking path, complete, total mindfulness. And I would fail every time. You know, there would be wandering mind and this and all the hindrances, like more than five hindrances would come up between here and the end of the path. So what I finally did was I finally said to myself, and this related to my life too, that I wouldn't make this kind of it's either all or nothing resolve. It would be, I have the resolve to be as mindful as I can, to be as aware as I can. And I'm going to just accept myself, however it turns out to be. So just as an example on a walking path, I would walk on a path outside and I would see a little pebble or something and I would say, just to there, you know. And it maybe even would be half the step and I would just, mindful, oh, it's gone, oh, come back, you know, and then take that next step. And that would be okay. That would be okay. So the resolve, we can practice resolve in so many ways, but give ourselves some slack to be human, for goodness sake, you know. But so when we have this resolution, this determination, it brings us kind of a balance inside, a steadfast balance that we know that we're going to go off, we're not going to be totally, completely, purely mindful all the time or aware or be virtuous totally, you know. We're going to slip and fall a lot. So can we give ourselves some space for being human? And that's the balance we need to have in our feeling of determination. We need to have this decisiveness, but to know that we're not always going to. It's not like being on a razor's edge, and if we go a little bit this way, we're going to completely fall off the path. It's like having a very wide stance. It's like a mountain, that kind of a stance, a just very broad-based mountain. When we sit here, that's the mountain that we are. Broad-based stance, ability to see how things are. And if we can't see, the ability to just admit we're just human. That's how it is. So I have a yogi friend. She gives me this permission to say this story about her. And she celebrated over 30 years of being sober through the help of the 12-step program. And she's a teacher in that, a lecturer in that too. So she happened to be with me on her 20th anniversary, and she was in a one-month retreat on Maui. And she did that to celebrate her 20th anniversary of being sober. And at the end of it, I said, congratulations, your resolve to be here was fulfilled. But there, you must be really good at resolve for being able to do this for 20 years. And you consider yourself a success at doing this. It must have taken a lot of power to do that, a lot of strength. You must have had really strong determination. And she said, oh no, it wasn't strong determination. She said, it was resolve every day, every moment, every thought that she had that she was not going to stay the course. She had to make the resolve, I'll stay the course. She had to make that decision every moment. This is the decision I'm making, I'm staying the course. When we walk the path and we're not mindful, or we see ourselves being unvirtuous, however that, whatever that means to us, then we make a resolve again to stay the course. That's why it says, I undertake the training. And that's why those words are in our precepts. I undertake the training to refrain from whatever it is. So we're doing that all the time, our resolve to undertake the training to stay on the path. It's not a strident, like, strong oomph determination, and then we do it. So a sense of resolve and knowing that we'll keep coming back to that resolve gives us a deep and genuine sense of trust in ourselves, because that's the path that we are kind of deepening in our lives. And we know that when things go kind of kaflooey, we're going to fall back on that path. We're going to know where that path is, because it now has a very deep groove. And we know that when we go off, oh, that doesn't feel good. So when we come back to that groove, that we're making what a friend and yogi of mine said, new cow paths of the mind. Not the old ones where we fall into the hindrances, but the ones where we can fall into the more beautiful states that we're doing, we're practicing. So staying with the practice. I remember the first time that I went through, I think some of you have heard the story that I told on Friday night more than once, where in my practice at one point I had made the resolve to do a one-month retreat, my second one-month retreat, and I felt like in that retreat there were four horses tied to each of my limbs and they were pulling me in different directions. That's the pain that I had in the body. It was so deep pain in the body. And so I just stayed with it. And there were many things that happened, and the guidance that I, good guidance that I had to stay with it, and the ability to see things that I'd never seen before, not only in the pain, but in the peace that could come afterwards. When I went to see my teacher at the end, I said, will I ever experience this kind of pain again? And he said, no. And the next time when I went to practice with him, it was a longer time of practice, I experienced really deep physical pain again. And I went to him and I was really not happy, you know, with that. And I said, I thought, he didn't tell me the truth, you know. And he didn't even say something like, you know, something soothing or something more realistic. But the last time, so when I went to him this time, I said, you told me that I would never experience this pain again, and now it's happening again. And he said, it's true, you would never experience that pain again. This is a new pain that you're experiencing. And yeah, duh. And he didn't tell me that before, probably because he wanted me to come back, you know. So, but going through that pain, that crossing that flood of that inner pain really helped me to see other things, you know, deeper things, experience a kind of peace that is in relationship to going through that kind of pain. So, you know, there's all kinds of things that come on the path. We just don't know. I love this by Goethe. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectualness. Concerning all acts of initiative, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid intentions. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issue from that decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no one could have dreamed would come his way. Whatever you can do or dream you can begin, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Begin it now. So this has to do with our aspiration. You know, our aspiration may be to get through a difficult period or to smile more in life. I mean, that was my aspiration at one point in life, just to be able to smile more. Or to reach the end of suffering, or to be able to die with as few regrets as possible. So, you know, what is your aspiration? Where can you commit yourself to something about your own vow to yourself that maybe you could have some trust in? Maybe you could know for yourself that this is possible for me. And not to make it too high either. And to keep it, one of my teachers, a good friend, kind of been a surrogate mother to me, is a Christian mystic. And she always said to keep your vows silent and secret, just to yourself, you know, because it's so personal in a way. So this is another, David White has been with me a lot in these past few days, so some of his poems have really spoken to me. This is about all the true vows. How many of you have heard that one by David White? All the true vows, yeah. All the true vows are secret vows. The ones we speak aloud are the ones we break. There is only one life you can call your own, and a thousand others you can call by any name you want. Hold to the truth you make every day with your own body. Don't turn your face away. Hold to your own truth at the center of the image you were born with. Those who do not understand their destiny will never understand the friends they have made, nor the work they have chosen, nor the one life that waits beyond all others. By the lake in the wood, in the shadows, you can whisper that truth to the quiet reflection you see in the water. Whatever you hear from the water, remember, it wants to carry the sound of its truth on your lips. Remember, in this place, no one can hear you. And out of the silence, you can make your promise. You can make a promise. It will kill you to break. That way you'll find what is real and what is not. I know what I'm saying. Time almost forsook me, and I looked again. Seeing my reflection, I broke a promise and spoke for the first time after all these years in my own voice before it was too late. So what's your promise to yourselves? Simple, human. Let's sit for a moment.